Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. It's been a while since last we spoke of elections and voting. Tonight, as we take a step back, look down from 30,000 feet at your right to vote and voting technology. We've spoken of elections, election law, and election software. And joining me in the studio as tonight's co-host is my go-to for all voting issues, better known as the Real Advocate, Brent Turner. Brent?
I'm here, Jeff. Can you hear me?
You're on the air, and we hear you fine.
Great. Hey, thank you, and thanks for the shout-out. I'm glad to be here with our great guest. It's an honor to be on the show here with Secretary of State Bill Gardner, so I'm looking forward to your intro and getting to some good information.
So tonight in Your Legal Rights, we again discuss elections, voting, how you cast your votes, and what happens to them afterwards. Our conversation starts with when you begin to cast your vote, when you arrive. In parts of the country, it may be that sometime after you arrive before you actually get to vote, and others, maybe how you vote. Some places use mail-in votes, others simple technology, others advanced system, the voting machinery, the software. Really, everything voting is open. You wanted to hear how the sausage is being made. You're in the right place. Anyone who watched this season of Curb Your Enthusiasm knows that the final season evolved around a fictitious version of Larry David handing a bottle of water to somebody waiting in line in the hot sun to vote, getting arrested, and then angering enough people along the way to make it a season. You know, the laws against lending comfort, food, or drink to someone in the line are real. And the procedures, the limitations, the variables that affect who votes, how votes are made, how they're collected, how they're counted, vary throughout different locales in the country. And who better to discuss them? Joining Brent and I tonight, Bill Gardner was first elected New Hampshire Secretary of State in 1976, where he served thereafter until 2022. Elected more times than any other Secretary of State anywhere in the country, any time in the nation's history, and amongst the longest serving in that office. In that role, Bill was in charge of the department that oversees all general elections, primary elections, voter registration, and recounts within the state, including the New Hampshire primary. Secretary Gardner participated in President Trump's Voter Fraud Commission, which was set up by then-President Trump in the wake of his unsubstantiated claims of voter fraud in the 2016 election, at which Secretary Gardner called for an analysis of the value of photo IDs laws in improving public confidence in elections, later criticizing President Trump's unsubstantiated claim that out-of-state voters were being bused into New Hampshire to vote. It's hard to imagine anyone in the country who could have amassed more knowledge about elections, election laws, and election technology than Secretary Bill Gardner. There's much to discuss. For starters, give us a call. We welcome you to join in our discussions. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255. Bear in mind that our guests are not going to provide you precise legal advice. They're here to help. They're here to inform. They're here to educate. And with that, joining us tonight, Secretary Gardner, let me welcome you to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm pleased to join you.
You know, it seems that while some states require folks to stand in long lines, others have all but replaced in-person voting with absentees. And some would question that as to access to the polls varying throughout the county. But when we were talking before the show, you did some interesting analysis of whether making it really easy to vote has been beneficial and what its effect. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We are probably the state that has the least number of absentee ballots cast in the country. And we were late in even getting absentee ballots. It wasn't until 1944 that any person could ever vote by absentee. It was in the middle of World War II, and it's because our Constitution that was ratified, our state Constitution, in 1784, before the federal Constitution. It says that when a person votes, the person must be present. And there were attempts to change that Constitution, and they failed in the 20s after World War I. Then again in the late 30s, it was put on the ballot for the people, and it failed. And it passed in 1944, but only for November general elections. It didn't include local elections or state primaries or the presidential primary. And it started when Abraham Lincoln asked the northern states to allow the soldiers to vote during the Civil War. And when the New Hampshire legislature decided to take that issue up, it was informed by the Supreme Court that it had to be an amendment to the Constitution. And so it didn't happen. And we were one of the later states. Our Constitution still has the word present, but there's a provision that says that if you are not able to physically get to the polls because you're out of state or out of town, you're away, or you're not physically able to get there, then you can vote by absentee ballot, but that's the requirement.
You know, by contrast, California in the last 10 years has all but eliminated in-person voting, moving towards an almost all mail-in voting system. I'm old school. I like the idea of going in and voting in person. I miss the days when you would hit that first lever and the curtain would close behind you. And I very seldom see more than one or two other people anymore voting in person. Do you have thoughts on the value of voting in person versus voting in writing?
I believe that what you have just described is the cause of the belief that a majority of the adults in this country have in their mind. Associated Press, within the last year, twice, have found that by polling the country, slightly less than half of U.S. adults have confidence that their votes will be counted accurately in the 2024 election. 46% said that they believe that their votes would be counted accurately. Think about that. That's a serious matter for the country to deal with. If that's And that's pretty consistent. This is just the two recent polls sponsored by Associated Press and the polling firm that they use. for all adults in the country. And if people don't trust or believe that their votes are counted accurately, they stop voting. And
at best.
But what you, this idea that we're going to make it easier and easier and easier, that's for some reason it's not the people's fault that they don't vote, it's the government's fault. And that reached the crescendo back in the late 80s and early 90s, and in 1993 the Congress passed what was called the National Voter Registration Act, but it was commonly referred to as the motor voter law. And all the states were required to allow people to register by mail. There was a there is a national form, and it required that the it opened up the process, made it much easier. Outside groups, political groups, could actually go around and register voters. And in that legislation, there was a provision that said any state that had Election Day registration could be exempt from this. It's an interesting story. If you had it at the time the bill passed, well, New Hampshire passed it. It wasn't by the time the bill passed, but it was before the next federal election, because the local officials in this state said they wanted to keep voter registration a person-to-person matter, so that a person has to do it in person. And if that was it's the only way to keep that was to have Election Day registration, then that's what we're going to do. And so we're a state of 1.3 million, very small. There are three other states today that are like us, and they're small. Wyoming, Idaho, North Dakota doesn't have a type of... Those states are exempt from that law as well. And if you look at the voting turnout since that passed in 93, you look at every presidential election since 96 on, you can see the results factually. What are the results of this? So New Hampshire doesn't have all these things that you have in California. Not only does our Constitution say you must be present to vote, and we just have these few exceptions, but it also says that you must have the results done election night. So any person who wants to go to their polling place, or any polling place, before the workers leave that polling place, they will publicly announce to the people there how many votes each person on the ballot got, including the absentee ballots, on election night. And that's how it's always been done here in New Hampshire. And that's another one of the problems, that when you have early voting and late voting, and you are creating a process that people are not familiar with. They really don't know how it works, and they become skeptical about it, versus a place where you can see how it's being done. The ballots are all there. And in New Hampshire, we have a law that you have to vote on a paper ballot. Nobody pushes a lever. Everybody votes by ballot. And that has turned out to be very good for us, because with the computer now and the internet, you can't hack a pencil. And so when people vote, they're voting with their pencil. And the belief of the accuracy of the vote here and our local at the University of New Hampshire, the Granite State poll, they've polled people on this question for almost two decades now, and it's almost 100%. People can see the process. They can stay there. It's done that night. Nothing is going to happen unless there's a recount. And we've had a recount that a U.S. Senate election was decided by 3 votes, and that's what got me started in all this back in 1974 and 1975 when we had that election, and all of our election laws were put under a microscope here, and a lot of things were found out that the public wasn't aware of, like candidates could actually get absentee ballots and bring them to nursing homes, and a lot of the laws were changed, tightening up all of that, and they've been loosened a little bit in these last 40 years. But this, if the question is, how did we get to where we are right now? How do we have a great country like ours and have these arguments and disagreements and disbelief about the accuracy of our own votes? I mean, that is not something to be taken lightly, and the answer has been, for the last 30 years, we just have to make it easier. We have to keep making it easier and easier and easier. And the facts show that it has actually resulted in fewer people voting. And that's factual. That's not an opinion. That if you... The statistics are available for each state, and your state in particular, and you have, I don't want to tell California how the people of California should vote, just like I don't want the people in California telling the people in New Hampshire how to vote. Our process is a different one. It's similar to the way it was in most states going back 30 plus years ago. But as the federal government has come in and changed it, and I'm not talking about the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act served a very important purpose in this country. But the way people actually vote, making it easier, and it's counterintuitive. It's like, how can anybody be against making it easier to vote? Well, it's pretty hard to take that position unless you have facts, and facts over a lengthy period of time, because you can't compare one election to another. You've got to compare several of them to really come to a conclusion about something, because sometimes you might have a U.S. Senate race, other times you might not, and there's 3 ways to count turnout. One is voting age population. That's the denominator that goes back in time the longest. So if you want to get an idea of what it was like in the 30s and the 40s and then after World War II, you have to use voting age population. They have a new one now that some professor have come up with called voting eligible. And then there's a third one that's based on the voting age population and the turnout for highest office in the state. So whether it's governor or U.S. Senate, voter turnout ranking based on the vote for highest office divided by the voting age population, not the total number of people that actually came out to vote. It's the how many actually voted for the office that got the most votes statewide. Could be president, could be governor, could be U.S. Senate. So there's a few different ways to do it. And
Bill, I have a question for you. With all that being said, where does New Hampshire rank? And first of all, I want to say thank you for joining the show and thanks for your leadership in the country. I think, you know, I'm a fan of New Hampshire simply because of all the great work that you've done, but also because you were integral to the effort toward open source software in election systems and your work with New Hampshire Prime 3, Dr. Juan Gilbert, and now VotingWorks, who is the first vendor in the country to provide open source paper ballot election systems. Where does, and that is a big part of this story of your legacy, because even though Mississippi beat you to the punch, I think they deployed systems initially, but New Hampshire now seems to be moving that needle quite extensively, and that will be a big signal to the rest of the country that California certainly could have sent, but politically it's a quagmire. My question is, how does New Hampshire rank for turnout in comparison to California?
Well, there's no comparison. If you look at the California turnout, if you start with the first election after the National Voter Registration Act in 1996, presidential, so you have 96, 2000, 04, 08, 12, 16, and 20. California has been the highest based on the rest of the country, was 43rd. In 2012 and 2016, California was 49th. So it's been between 43rd place and 49th place. It's been 44th, 45th, 46th, twice. And now, you know, California's a big state. And it's not an easy thing to conduct elections, and I'm not. It's easier when it's a small state, and but there's no comparison between New Hampshire. New Hampshire's been since '96. New Hampshire five of those seven presidential elections, New Hampshire had the third highest turnout in the country, and then the fourth highest, and then the sixth highest. And it's been going up from 96.
I appreciate it. Let me ask you, before we go to station ID break real quick, what is the reception to the upgraded software systems been? Are people happy with the systems that are now working with the open source?
People are very happy with it. For the first time, five communities already have purchased a company. It's called VotingWorks, and there are more towns coming along right now. The State Ballot Law Commission that is made up of, it's a bipartisan board, and they allowed for VotingWorks. They allowed this within the last year. We supported open source back when the federal government got involved in overseas voting. It's not the state. The people here vote by a paper ballot. So they've always been concerned about voting using a system that they don't understand. So that's a strong belief here, and also a strong belief to keep the process as simple as possible. And open source does that. Open source will provide answers to the questions that a lot of people have been asking for years, that how do they trust this process? And that lack of trust, that's what produced the concept of early voting 25 years ago. There wasn't early voting. People weren't taking ballots 10 days after an election or 15 days, allow ballots to be cast afterwards. And that's what has created this doubt in people's minds, these questions. If the voting population is made up of humanity, all of humanity, and there are classes of intellect, and you don't want to create a voting process that hurts one class or another class. You want it to be done in a way that everybody believes in it and trusts it and understands it. Otherwise, we're just, we're in a bad way now. We're with 46%, that's all, of the voting adults in this country believe that their vote will be accurately counted. Most people don't. It can't continue. Or we're jeopardizing a free society.
I'm with you.
And thanks. That's a poignant note to finish this half hour. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, joined by co-host Brent Turner. Tonight, we're discussing voting rights, election law, voting technology, with former Secretary of State for the state of New Hampshire, Bill Gardner, elected more times than any other, and amongst the longest serving and perhaps the most distinguished Secretary of State anywhere in the nation. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking about election law, voting technology. Perhaps you have a question for one of the longest-serving elections officials in the nation's history. Whatever be your question, you're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights, and we'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
And we're back. And Mr. Secretary, in doing some of the research about your back, the one time I saw that you got some significant criticism was supporting a law that called for stricter residency requirements for out-of-state students to vote in New Hampshire. Can you tell us a little bit about that issue and how it resolved?
That issue came to be because there was a Supreme Court decision that this was a suit that began in 2012, and in that decision, our Supreme Court said that you could not have in the definition of domicile resident, you could not require someone to be willing to say that they intend to, when they're registering to vote, that they intend to remain in New Hampshire for the indefinite future. And some lawyers picked up on that and said, well, what about someone who's coming here to New Hampshire, and they have a definite belief that they're going to be leaving in 5 years, then they can't register. And my argument was that, wait a minute, indefinite is indefinite. They may not be alive the next day. They're just saying that they're here now, and they don't have a plan that they're going to be leaving the next day. Well, the Supreme Court made that call, but then when the legislature took indefinite out of the law, there was then a case brought, and the Supreme Court reversed it. It was because of, they went to federal court, and the federal court asked 5 questions of the New Hampshire Supreme Court. And when the New Hampshire Supreme Court answered those 5 questions, they said that the word indefinite and the word definite cannot be taken literally. So they basically said neither one really means anything. Someone might have a definite plan and they change their mind the next day. So for a period of about 5 years, we had a situation, because of that Supreme Court decision, that a person didn't have to be a resident in order to vote in New Hampshire. And that made us the only state in the country, because of that court decision, that you didn't have to be a resident. And I can tell you that when that first decision came down, I got a call from a town clerk in New Hampshire who told me that she just got off the phone with a guy from California who owns a cottage on a lake in New Hampshire. And he read online that in New Hampshire you don't have to be a resident anymore to vote. And so he wanted to be able to register to vote because his vote meant more, he felt, than it did in California. And so we were in this kind of a bad legal situation. We're out of it now. Now it's clear. The court just said, look, yeah, we said that definite meant something, but we were wrong when we said that. Because if a law says indefinite, does that mean any more than a law a person that says, well, I have a definite plan to do this tomorrow? Well, is anything really definite? And so it was a legal mess that happened, and that was right in the middle of that commission. And so when the commission met in New Hampshire, there were people that were saying that, well, New Hampshire is allowing all these people to vote who don't even live here. And my point was, that's not, there is a court decision on that, and we have to abide by that decision as long as that decision stays in effect. And it was within a couple of years of that point that it's all been changed now. So that was the issue. It's a ridiculous situation, because indefinite versus definite, but that's how some lawyers decided to make the case that indefinite was unconstitutional, because you might have a definite plan. And I mean, think about it, discuss that. But the court got it right in the end and said you can't.
Hey, Secretary, I have another question for you. What do you think about the current environment for secretaries of states? I mean, should we feel bad for them? Are they going to be okay? you know, these current systems, I'm in agreement with you, they're, you know, not to throw gasoline on the fire of distrust, but moving the systems toward transparency is obviously the best thing we can do. But we have to acknowledge there has been some, and let me know your thoughts on this, there's been some interesting, I don't want to say nefarious, but interesting activity around vendors that peddle software systems that are proprietary. You know, NASED, the feds, everybody seems to have taken positions that haven't really panned out. And now the secretaries of state are the ones suffering. Do you have any thoughts for them, if and people that might want to become secretary of state at this point?
Well, first and foremost, a secretary of state who has the authority as the chief state election official, and there's 37 states that have it as the secretary of state, that office has to be trusted. It has to be, has to have faith that the people have faith that it's, everything is being done fairly for everyone. And I was able to get elected the first time as a minority party person because I said, and I had demonstrated in the legislature, that when it comes to elections, you have to be first and foremost fair. It doesn't matter what the person's philosophy, what party, if they have a party, those things have to all be put aside. You have to have a system that everyone feels they have an equal opportunity to be a part of. And I said, when I ran for Secretary of State the first time, that I would not use the office as a political stepping stone. Not only that, but I would not run. If I lost, and I was elected when I was 28, if I lost the next election, I would be out because I'm not going to come back. I'm not going to run for some other office. And I said that almost 50 years ago, and I've abided by that because I believe that. And you have to work with people that are have far different beliefs than you or different parties, but it doesn't matter. The ideal situation is for a chief election officer to have the respect and the belief and the proof by the actions of the person that everyone gets the same opportunity. And in New Hampshire, the Secretary of State does the recounts. I've done over 550 recounts. I've done recounts in the several statewide, and we count the ballots. And we let the candidates involved in the recount see every single ballot that was cast. And that allows for people who lose to actually feel better about it because they see the ballots. They see how people actually mark the ballots. And it works. But when you don't trust the process, and you don't see it, or you make it difficult to get recounts, or it's so, in a big state, it's more difficult than it is in a small state like New Hampshire, because we can pick up the ballots. The farthest town away from the capital is maybe 120 miles, 150 miles. That's it. So the process, and everything is done election night, and all the returns are brought back to the Secretary of State's office. the next morning, state police have several dozen locations where they pick up the returns, and the returns are signed by the election officials that work in the polling place. And those people elected in the polling place are elected by the people of the polling place. Nobody works in a New Hampshire polling place who doesn't vote there. So when people come in to vote, that's part of the, it's part of the process. And one thing that you probably have no idea about is that I had this conversation when President Trump said the questions about the buses coming into New Hampshire. And I had the opportunity some months later to talk to him about that. And I said, let me tell you what it's like when someone comes in to vote. When they come in to vote, they show an ID. If they don't have an ID, if anyone who works in the polling place knows them or recognizes them or can vouch for them, then that person can vote. But if no one recognizes them and they don't have any identification, they can still vote if they sign an affidavit and they have their picture taken. And he looked at me, have their picture taken? I never heard that before. And I said, well, that's probably because only someone from New Hampshire could tell you that, because there's no other place in the country that does that. And I said, in the last presidential election, we had 750,000 people voting, which was a high turnout, and we had 744 people that had their picture taken. And of those people, not one left. Do you think that an illegal person, someone who shouldn't be voting, is going to stand there and have their picture taken? They're going to run out of the building. And he was amazed about that. He said, well, I never heard that. I said, well, that's the way we do it. And we didn't have one person who refused. And we do have a provision, religious-related provision, that would be an exemption. And that's not been used. But that's part of that's the difference. You know, that's the difference between legislation making the country all the same. And just like California would not want New Hampshire to dictate to California how it conducts its elections, and we don't want California dictating to New Hampshire. And we have two representatives in the U.S. House out of 435. California has 50-something. So California would have more influence if it's a federal law than we would, making our own decision. And that's a whole another matter that I can talk about, because I saw how it all happened in the 70s when the Federal Election Campaign Act passed. And part of the reason that our elections are the way they are, there's not just one reason. The voting machines are part of it. When the Congress decided to pass the Help America Vote Act, they were all promoting state-of-the-art voting equipment. You didn't have to have a paper trail. That's what caused Georgia to have the problems that it had, because they would have been like Florida in 2000 because they had punch cards like Florida. But not only the punch cards, it was people being sent home because they had voted registered at Disney World, or some political group registered them but never sent it in. So that's where they came up with provisional ballots. And the provisional ballots led to the voting now after Election Day. So you've got 3 days or 5 days or 10 days or 15 days to correct it. So these changes that have been made at the federal level have created what we have today. And what we have today, anyone who wants to factually publish this kind of information, and it doesn't happen because it's not what the people that are interested in elections in a way that it's not for the common good. So it's a sad situation. It's compared to the way it was 40 years ago, and people will say, well, that's ridiculous. Anybody that supports or is against all these attempts to make it easier, why can't we let people vote days and days before? Well, when you do that, and this is how it actually happened. Georgia bought voting machines for the whole state with no paper trail, and the people in the state at the first election were very upset about it, and they had a lot of problems. And so the next election, it reached a critical mass, and they demanded to be able to vote using paper. And Georgia said, okay, we've spent all this Help America Vote PAC money. We're going to keep these machines, but we'll give you your paper, but you're going to have to vote before Election Day because we're not going to have Election Day with polling places with machines and paper ballots. We've got enough things going on than to double this. So that's how early voting began in this country. It began because of what happened in Georgia. People weren't trusting. And when it reached, and I happened to see the poll back then, it was in 2005 of Georgia, it was like 40% of the people back then were saying that they didn't feel good that their vote was being counted properly. And that is when this, what we have today with half the country not feeling good about our elections, either not believing that they're fair, are that their vote is actually being counted the way they cast it. That's where we are today. And that's how I have lived as an election official watching this process for the last 5 decades.
Bill, let me ask you, some of our local municipalities, at least in this region, have established and really embraced the idea of ranked choice voting to avoid the expense of a runoff. It hasn't always gone well. And of course, with this proprietary software where you can't see what they did wrong, it's really had some interesting results. Are you familiar with ranked choice, and do you have a position on it?
Yes. I had the person, his name was Steve Abrams, 30 years ago, it was called approval voting, and he was a professor. I believe it was at NYU. It was in New York City. I believe it was NYU. And he was born and brought up in Concord, the capital city of New Hampshire. And he came up to see me and gave me a book that he wrote about it. He called it approval voting. We've had approval. Ranked choice voting is, there's 4 or 5 names to it. It's all basically the same. But after I read his book back then, I talked to him about it, and I was familiar because with elections in Cambridge, Mass, because I went to school there for some years, and they had ranked choice back in the 70s when I was down there. And they didn't have results sometimes for 2 weeks after the election. And it was just, it's a very complicated, and it can be, I mean, the idea behind it, you can make a compelling argument that it accomplishes, forces people to to vote in a moderate way. But at that time, there were only five or six cities that had that kind of voting back in the 70s. And all but one got rid of it. And I remember here in Burlington, Vermont, well, you know, our next door state, Burlington had it for a local election. And a friend of mine who was in the New Hampshire House, his brother ended up getting to be elected mayor by it. And then the people were so mad after that at what happened that they threw it out in Burlington, Vermont. But the places that had it, I think Aspen, Colorado had it, there were cities in the country. And there's been a number of unintended consequences. When it comes to elections, you can't think of everything. Candidates, a lot of candidates we have, they think of different things. They try to think of ways how they can get elected and using the system that exists. And you can't, it's a humbling experience. Predicting results of changes to election laws, because you can have the most idealistic attitude and you think you're doing the right thing, but you can't think of all the things when you've got thousands of people involved in this process, what they come up with. And my belief has been, for all these years, keep it simple. You're not dealing with just people that have graduate degrees or college degrees. You're dealing with humanity. And you should strive for a process that fits humanity. And that way, you know, the ideal that we're all equal when it comes to vote, because my vote, it doesn't mean any more than your vote or someone else's. If you're in the line in the polling place and the person in front of you is the smartest person in your community, and the person in back of you is the richest, and the person in back of that person is the strongest, and the person in front is the most beautiful, inherited. The paradox of equality is that you cannot make economic equality, or human, but the vote itself, that's the strongest person in town, that person's vote is just like your vote. You have one vote, that person has one vote. What you might not have is that person has an economic opportunity, that person could have a bully pulpit and spend a lot more money and this, and we can go on. But that's being human. That's what we deal with. But there are other things that we all have something that makes us, you know, what we are and appreciates it. So keep it simple so that everyone can do it in a way that they understand it. And that's why that comes back to open source. You don't want hidden things. You want things to be open. You want to be able to answer all the questions and let all the people have an opportunity to get answers for their questions, no matter what level it is. And people that are the geniuses when it comes to the internet and that world versus people that have a hard time just doing simple arithmetic, you've got to have a system that is most humanly possible that fits for both.
Thank you. Thank you, Secretary, for those good words, and thanks for being a leader in the community. We know California is different than New Hampshire, and so it's not apples to apples, but yet it is of note that you have taken the lead to upgrade the security around the systems, and the fact that New Hampshire and Mississippi are leading on this begs the question, what's going on with New York and California, although your recognition of the HAVA debacle, that of course, again, that was vendor-driven with some backroom things going on, that $4.5 billion issue and those systems that were put into place were not appropriately secured. And that was a big issue at the time. But now moving on, we've got what we've got, and we just want to thank you for joining the show and for showing leadership to the country on how better security allows the loser to recognize they've lost.
That HAVA bill, remember, the main congressman in the House ended up in jail for 3 years.
Rush Holt.
With, Congressman Nye.
Bob Nye.
He wrote a book about that, and that was that's Abramoff, that guy that went to jail because they tried to put this amendment on Harvard. They knew it was a bill that was going to pass, and so they were attempting to do things in that bill because it was going to pass anyway, and they weren't. And that created provisional ballots, that created what happened in Georgia. It began the early voting, and now the provisional now voting 10 days, 15 days after an election.
I hate to cut you off, but we are out of time. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we've been discussing an overview of a revolution. We've been talking about voting and the ways different states have gone and how hard it is to get everyone on the same page. Our guest tonight has been former Secretary of State for the state of New Hampshire, Bill Gardner, the most often elected, amongst the longest serving, and perhaps the most distinguished Secretary of State from anywhere in the country. Tonight's show was produced by yours truly and my co-host tonight, Brent Turner. Next week, Bill Hing, a professor of law at the University of San Francisco, will join us and discuss his book, Humanizing Immigration, How to Transform Our Racist and Unjust Immigration System. Best of all, as always, we'll take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's guest, Bill Gardner, and to tonight's co-host, Brent Turner. And thanks to all of you for joining us. And on behalf of Your Legal Rights, a big thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.